All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on the third day of December 2019. And I do like to remind you that I am the editor of a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. You can subscribe to that by going to miningstocks.com, miningstocks.com. Or call our office in New York during normal working hours, 718-457-1426, 718-457-1426. I'd like to also encourage you to consider subscribing to Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? ChenPicks.com is the place to go for that. And I want to thank each of you for listening to this show and making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel. Also want to invite you to keep your questions, comments, whatever you have to say about this show, send them along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions4taylor@gmail.com. And, of course, we do want to thank our sponsors because without them there would be no show. Irving Resources, Novo Resources, Great Bear Resources, Gatling Exploration, and TriStar Gold Resources. And we'll be hearing from the President and CEO, Nav Dhaliwal, of Gatling Exploration. He'll be with us in just a few minutes from now after our first commercial break. I've titled today's show, An Inflationary Depression. Alistair MacLeod, Michael Oliver is back with us, and Nav Dhaliwal will be with us once again. He was here on behalf of another company in the past, but Nav Dhaliwal of Gatling will be with me after the first commercial break, as I just noted. Financial markets are ignoring bearish developments in international trade, which coincide with the end of a long expansionary phase for credit. Both empirical evidence from the one occasion these conditions existed in the past and reasoned theory suggest the consequences of this collective folly will be enormous, undermining both financial asset values and fiat currencies. The last time this coincidence occurred was in 1929 to 1932, leading into the Great Depression, when prices of commodities and output prices for consumer goods fell heavily. With unsound money and a central banking determined to maintain prices, illusions of prosperity may continue to exist, but depression conditions will exist nonetheless. Those were the quotes of Alistair MacLeod in the introductory piece that he wrote on October 3rd in his essay titled An Inflationary Depression, which you can read, and I would suggest you do if you're serious about this very important topic. Go to goldmoney.com to read Alistair's essay of October 3rd. He has several since then, but the October 3rd one is the one we want to focus on today. So you may be wondering how we can have an inflationary situation when we enter a depression. So we'll be asking Alistair to walk us through his argument for an inflationary depression as opposed to the deflationary depression he talked about in the 1930s. And as I just noted, Nav Dhaliwal, the CEO of one of our sponsors to this show, Gatling Exploration, will join me to introduce that evolving multi-million ounce gold exploration play that's going on in Ontario that Mr. Dhaliwal heads up. Gatling's geological team is led by Dale Ginn, whom I've known for many years. Dale and Nav were on to a major gold discovery at the on behalf of Bonterra before certain financiers, got involved in merging a struggling Quebec gold producer into Bonterra. Dale and Nav then left that company to work on Gatling's emerging multi-million ounce gold deposit known as the Larder Project. And I personally own some shares of Gatling, so I'm going to be paying close attention, you can bet on that, to hear what Nav has to say And he'll be with me, as I said, right after commercial break a few minutes from now. But now I'm really happy to tell you that Michael Oliver is back with us again this week. And I'm also happy to tell you that you should go to olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com. And I say that because it is a momentum structural analysis is the best technical analyst newsletter that I have ever read. And that's why we have Michael on the show. Almost, well, whenever he wants to come on, he's welcome. So thank you for joining me again, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
It's really good to have you here. And 12:15 this morning. Well, I didn't get up at 12:15. I got up at around 6:30. But when I came down to turn on my computer, I saw an email in my inbox from you at 12:15 New York time is when it arrived in my inbox. And you were commenting on Monday's market action, and you said, and I quote, "It certainly was not just closing below the 10-day average that broke stuff today. Other indicators also broke, as did the VIX index to the upside. So what now?" You posed that question. So what now? And, of course, you had to read on to determine what comes next. So, of course, today the equity market is down strong. As you just noted, the dollar is down a bit. Gold is up, and we're seeing the treasuries up. But talk to us about as much as you care to tell us about what you put out to your subscribers today, because I sense it's a pretty important message.
Well, we when we analyze markets like the S&P, which is critical, and it's also critical for gold. So gold investors should be paying a maximum amount of attention right now, not just to gold, but to the dollar index and to the S&P 500, because we think they will engage soon to assist gold in its next phase of its upside. The S&P 500, we measured on a short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term basis, looking at momentum trend structures using long-term averages on down to short-term. And sometimes you can get short-term swings in any market that don't really mean much. You know, they're a trading situation. They come and go in a few weeks, et cetera, et cetera. They might be counter to the major trend, so they're just sort of nuisance swings, that's all. But we're watching the S&P because it has a layered structure underneath it on each time scale. So in other words, we see a short-term negative situation as of yesterday's close. So sure enough, today was down pretty nicely. And the question is, will it engage the next level below it, monthly momentum, for example? Will monthly momentum then break and engage quarterly momentum, which then engages annual momentum? It's not always the case when you look at different time scales on a given market that they're all lined up to be used to break through. But right now the S&P, and this again we keep stating this, you can go back a century in the U.S. stock market and you cannot find a momentum trend situation so well structured for a major decline. Yes. In 1929 and 1987, for example, there was only one time scale that engaged to the downside, and that was quarterly momentum. It was not annual momentum. You did not break anything on annual momentum in those crashes. In fact, the crashes stopped at the 36-month averages. So there was a big difference between when you broke quarterly momentum and collapsed the next 30% just to get to the three-year average or the 36-month average. This time, it is totally different. The various triggers to the downside are fairly tightly arranged below the market. So if you drop X percent, you could engage that trigger, which gets you to the next trigger, which it's like a domino effect. We've never seen it so pristine, and it is really set up for to go. Right now, we just broke the short term. Question is, will it flounder around enough, which is basically what we think is going to happen this month. It's not some major drop, but a wounding, perhaps. You know, a fumbling around where people will still debate, is it up or is it down, et cetera. Because if the S&P wobbles around between now and the next quarter, which is only 20-some trading days away, certain numbers are going to rise on quarterly momentum that could be engaged without much effort on the downside. And, of course, we specify those in our reports. But so we're watching for December to maybe just sort of fumble its way through the end of the year and position itself where it basically defaults a downside breakout on longer-term momentum. This is what happened in 2008, by the way. The end of 2007, it closed at insufficiently firm levels, so when you opened 2008, you broke structure. The same thing happened in 2015. You close the year at the wrong spot, close the quarter at the wrong spot. When you open 2016, whoosh, 200 points to the downside.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite common. So anyway, we're quite on the edge of our seat here. And we also notice that the dollar is maneuvering its way back down toward the key structures it has.
Mm-hmm.
And we suspect the dollar, when it breaks down, will be a fellow traveler with the S&P 500 downside.
Yeah, well, I know you've been saying of late that you thought that either or both the dollar and the commodity sector needs to change directions
yes.
in a meaningful way in order for gold to move. We're not seeing anything really meaningful yet. I guess you said the dollar is getting close to some key levels, but...
Bloomberg Commodity Index is very dormant still, but it's right below some key numbers. And I'm going to suspect that we get a dollar sell signal before we get a Bloomberg Commodity Buy signal. They're inversely related, and we think when the dollar does break, give us our signal that we've got based on our methodology, that we'll soon thereafter get an upside breakout by the Bloomberg. And, of course, the Bloomberg at that point, commodity index, will be echoing, much lagged, but it'll be echoing the positive trend of gold. This is what happened in the late 1970s, if you recall. You know, gold launched first, and about a year or so later, the Bloomberg Commodity Index, or the CRB index, turned up from a low and followed gold.
Mm-hmm. So let
that's
me just ask you.
Then, after all.
they're determined, and we'll be talking to Alistair MacLeod in the last section of today's show about some of those issues. But so let me get this straight. What you're saying is you called this a pristine structure. Again, what's the importance of that? You say it didn't happen
in 29. You don't want subjectivity. When you look at a chart, you don't want to have to interpret it. You want it to be very clear. It smacks you in the face with its trend clarity, meaning the structures that you plot. It's the same with price charts. You know, when you price chartists fumble around to draw trend lines on a price chart, and it's sort of guesswork, and then sometimes it's very clear. Well, in the case now with momentum, the structures are very clear, and they're horizontal, flat floors type structures. And when you break them, you go down. Now, these will break at levels that don't make much sense on a price chart. So the price chart folks aren't going to see the points of breakage that we see on momentum.
Right.
So to some extent, they'll be ambushed, and that's fine with us. Because quite often, the price chart folks, you know, the 20% rule, you're off the high by 20%, therefore you're a bear. That's usually about when they figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Takes that
yeah,
much.
Well, that's quite a lot of bleeding before you get to that point. And I have noticed, one of the things that's really impressed me with your work, Michael, is the fact that so often your structural stuff leads away and lets people get ready for the price stuff to break or to go in the other, you know, up or down. So that's what I've been...
One of the advantages we try to...
I would say that that's what I've observed, and one of the reasons that I think love to pay attention to your work. Not only the markets that we talk about frequently, but folks, if you really want to know what those next key areas are, those next key levels are that need to be broken before you go to the next step down, subscribing to the structure, the momentum structural analysis is very important. It's OliverMSA.com. Go there. Learn all you can about what Michael does, and I think you might do very well. Consider a subscription. Thank you so much for being with us again, Michael, and I guess we'll see you in a couple of weeks from now, hopefully.
Well, thank you, Jay. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Well, we do have to go to break, but don't go away. Nav Dhaliwal, the present CEO of Gadling Exploration, will be with us. This is a company that I think you can expect to see some very exciting news over the next, starting almost immediately, because they're going to have a very active drilling program through the winter. I think my expectations are that they will be very successful in building up a multi-million ounce gold deposit. That's something we'll have to wait and see, but that's what I believe they can do, and that's why I'm really happy to tell you that Nav Dhaliwal will be with me right after the commercial break, so don't go away.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
Gatling Exploration is aggressively expanding its 100% owned Larder Gold Project with three high-grade gold deposits located along the prolific Kirkland Larder Break in Ontario, Canada. 35,000 meters of drilling is underway, and to date has now connected two of the three gold deposits and is aiming at connecting the third to create a 4.5-kilometer trend. Gatling trades under GTR on the TSX Venture and GATGF on the OTCQX. Visit www.gatlingexploration.com to learn more.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really glad to be with Nav Dhaliwal again. He's the president and CEO of Gatling Exploration. He's here to introduce that story. Gatling is a sponsor of this show. We're very pleased about that, and I'm very pleased to tell you that I took advantage of a little weakness in the stock today to pick up some more personally. It is a recommendation in my newsletter, and Nav Dhaliwal and lead geologist Dale Ginn have been a successful team in the past. I followed them through another company, Bonterra. They were very successful. And then at one point, the financiers stepped in and decided they want to take the company in a different direction. They merged in a struggling producer in Quebec, and the emphasis on the great deposit that Dale and Nav were building was de-emphasized. Nav moved on with Dale to Gatling, and I'm really pleased to tell you that I'm really happy to have Nav with us today. Thanks for joining me, Nav.
I appreciate it, Jay. It's always a pleasure, and thanks for the intro there.
Yeah, it was I was really, quite frankly, as an investor, very disappointed that they took the company in a different direction, but I guess the people had the money, they could do what they wanted to do. But you guys were on to building a very substantial deposit there, I know. And then all of a sudden, everything got quiet, and you weren't talking about it. Now, you and Dale are back with the Larder project in Ontario, just across the border from Quebec. This is your first time talking about this story, so just tell us a little bit about that deposit. You already have close to 1 million ounces, even before you started working on it, four to 5.5 grams, somewhere in that range is the average grade. But what can you tell us about what you have now and what the prospects are for building on this deposit?
Absolutely, Jay. And to expand on that, that's right. We're going to do it again. We get out there, we find the right assets, and we raise the capital, put the right people together, and get to work. Because at the end of the day, the drill bit's got to talk to us and show them that our theories of what we're seeing here is panning out. So with Gatling, when we took a look at this, this was part of a package that we picked up while we were there, and we spun this out as we exited ourselves out of Bonterra. And so this is how Gatling was conceived. It was a spin out. It wasn't an RTO or anything else like that. So what we did was, back in the day, with Dale Ginn and myself and the rest of the team, we were looking at this Cadillac Larder Fault, looking for the next potential of building out a multi-ounce deposit. And right next door to Nickel Eagle's Queenston project, which in 2016, they were JV'd with Yamana, and they had bought out Yamana for $180 million. So this is now one of Agnico Eagle's biggest exploration projects that they're working on in Canada. We have now buttoned up, and when I say buttoned up, we've consolidated the eastern trend of this Canalec-Larder Fault. And what we've done is put together three deposits, the Bear Lake deposit, the Chaminade deposit, and the Fernland. Now, all three of these deposits historically, Jay, were looked upon independently. Nobody looked at them as cohesive, like, is there mineralization through this? Is this just one big deposit? So we put these three deposits together, and sure enough, in just recent news releases, when we started off back in earlier part of this year with a 10,000-meter drill program, very quickly bumped that up to 35,000, because when we get at it, we want to definitely keep at it. And why we were keeping at it is the success that we were having at the drill bit. Again, doing what we do best, we known that there was a 43-101 of 917,000 ounces inferred at 5.5 grams per ton. And that's primarily on the Bear Lake deposit. And that work was comprised by Goldfield, who did a $40 million option back in 2010 on the Bear Lake deposit. And in 2012, as we know, Goldfield shut down all their exploration and focused on their production. They left us with $6 million worth of work, 31,000 meters of drilling that was not included in that 43-101. So we're expanding on that. And quickly, from all that data and all the work, and Goldfield does impeccable work, we've quickly looked at the model, and again, 200-meter step out at depth, we've hit. Just recently, we've shown that there's mineralization connecting the Bear Lake and Chaminade deposit together. So we've connected two of the three deposits already. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we've aggressively upped our campaign to 35,000 meters. We intend on having that done in the early part of January. So again, we'll be rolling over to continue on drilling. Really consolidate the northern part of our land package, we did a deal with Teck. Teck spent over $2 million getting their property, and that property was connected or on the same trend as Agnico Eagle's Upper Beaver deposit. So it kind of made sense for us, being the only junior, especially, this is a good point to make out to the audience, Jay, we're the only junior in the area working. We're not competing for dollars. We're not competing for that attention. With the share, with our shares outstanding, we're a very tight structure. We've got cash in the bank, and we're continuing to drill out. So there's a lot of upside for not only the company, but everybody involved and people looking to get involved. As you mentioned, the share price has depressed a bit here, but again, with more news that we intend on putting out here in short order, we see quick turnaround on our stock.
Yeah. Dude, so you're finding the connection between these three different deposits that have been discovered in the past. Have you put out some information, some drill results from you just talked about going down 200 meters deeper? You've put out some drill results from that, Nav?
Absolutely. We put out everything that I've mentioned here in our interview has been out in the public forum now. The 200-meter step-outs that we've done at depth on showing the continuity of the actual deposit. And then further from that, just recently, we had a strike length of, I believe, 42 meters of 1.5 grams, showing that mineralization does go between the Bear and the Chaminade deposit. So again, we're very encouraged. We're continuing to drill out there. We have not stopped. So there's an abundance of news flow that's going to be happening with Gatling here. And I would expect that, you'll start seeing that news flow in the early part of the new year as we're starting to wind down this year, but winding down in the market sense. The company itself, let me state, is not winding down. We are continuing to move the needle by continuing having these drills spinning out there.
How much distance between these three deposits that have been recognized in the past? I mean, what sort of strike length between the three?
Yeah, no, and thanks. You know, sometimes when I get going, my excitement kind of gets the better of me. But to back it up, joining these three deposits will show a 4.5 kilometer strike. And what we've accomplished to date already, we've already aggressively proven out 2 kilometers of that 4.5. And again, there's a lot more drilling for us to do, and a lot more, you know, there's a lot more to be excited about here in short order.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the past, in fact, right to the east of where you are, you have what's the Curry-Addison mine that was some 10 million yeah. ounces that graded 10.5 million ounces that graded 10 grams per ton. Do you see this as the same? This is the same system.
We've got the same system, and that's what we're drilling off. Right. It's the same system, that Cadillac Larder Fault there. And you're right, and thank you for pointing that out. Curry-Addison was one of the more profitable, more economical deposits in Canada. It's such high grade and such a tight package to mine that's similar to what we're drilling out with these three deposits currently.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to mention also, with that being said, this is an area, a proven out gold camp that's been around for decades now, where the infrastructure is there for us. Gatling has patented ground, so we're not working exclusively on mining leases. The power, water, everything is there. You know, our community relations, that's something that's very important for me when I get into an area, is to definitely get out there and reach out to the communities first and foremost. So we've checked all the boxes as investors want to look at companies. Have they done their due diligence? Have they, you know, gone out and, like I just mentioned, checked all the boxes of, you know, jurisdiction and you know, are they financed? Do they have the team? Do they have the resources? We've checked all the boxes off for our shareholders here. And being in Canada, one of the more safer jurisdictions in the world right now, as we can see what's happening, I believe that, you know, the gold deposits are just, they'll be worth a lot more in the near future. Just seeing how, you know, we're a proactive mining country and money safe here.
Well, no doubt about that. So I know this is probably too early to answer this question definitively, but you have these three high-grade deposits, essentially, that have been established in the past. Now, you're mentioning that there's some probably lower grades. It hasn't been drilled that much, but you've proven the continuity with a lower grade in between two of these. Do you think, is the concept here that this may be one major deposit? Will it be three high-grade deposits? Or I know it's too early to say definitively, but what is the concept?
Well, exactly. In our theory going into this is that we see it, and, you know, with Dale and Nathan and Carly, our geologists, our geo team that's looking at this, we believe there is continuity throughout it all. Now, you're correct in stating that, you know, it is early days. We intend on doing a lot more. You know, we've got 35,000 meters, you know, to us, before we start looking at this, we've got to put another 100,000 meters plus of drilling down there, doing what we do. Jay, as you've seen before, we drill it out, we interpret the data. So as of right now, we see this low mineralization, but it's showing that there is mineralization. And now you're going to see these plungy, shooty, you know, these rotty type high grade that we'll be shooting through. So that's what we're targeting now, and seeing if there is continuity through the high grade, or you're just seeing these big shoots of these high grade shoots again, as I was just mentioning. But right now it's early days, and we want to continue to drill it out. And as we continue to drill it out, we can build out the model as well. But we're pretty confident, though, that we have 4.5 kilometers here.
I suppose when you talk about checking the boxes, metallurgy is probably the same as what is already known, because there's been mining and a lot of work done on this, and it's the same system, as you say, all the way over to Curry-Addison. So. The metallurgy is another box that you've checked. Not completely yet. You'll have to do more work, of course. But I wanted to ask you also, what about, you said you have money. How much do you have, and how far will that take you? When do you think you'll have to raise again?
No, absolutely. And as you know, we're junior explorers, and it's about definitely monitoring the balance sheet and making sure we're getting productivity out of it. So currently right now we're about $3 million. You know, that's going to put us into the early part of next year as we put out some more results and kind of show the investing community what we've been doing with the drilling that we've done. And I think in the second quarter of next year we'd look to bring on some solid investors alongside with us and kind of move it forward. You know, as it sits right now, we are looking at the value. There is a lot of value be created for existing shareholders or shareholders that are listening now and looking to get involved in junior gold explorers. I can't emphasize enough to the investing community, you're looking at a company that, you know, we've got a balance sheet, we're drilling, we're active, we're in the right jurisdiction. We're the only junior in this area, and we're starting off not just greenfields. We've got just under 1 million ounces sitting there, and right now, currently, our market cap's about $25 million. Right. I can't emphasize enough for people to take a look at this.
Well, no doubt about it, and in a gold bull market, which I think we're in, and today, of course, is encouraging me to think that's probably right. It is certainly worth a good look, and then always important, of course, you'll have a constant flow of drill results coming out in the next number of weeks, going into the spring, I guess, right? So,
absolutely, Jay, and that's what we've always been known for is keeping the market investing community and everybody involved apprised of the work that we're doing, not just showcasing some historical workings. Of course, people understand we got historical, but that's what we're known for. We get out there and we work our ground, and you know we wanted to work it the best and the most efficiently way that we can.
All right, very good. Well, we'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you very much, Nav, for being with us, and we'll look to keep up with this story as more drill results come out. Thank you so much.
Always appreciate it. Thank you, Jay.
You bet. Okay, folks, well, we do have to go to break, but Alistair McLeod will be back with me to talk about some things that may not be that pleasant, but we need to face reality as much as we can, and I think Alistair is here to talk about something that he believes may be in our future, and that is an inflationary depression. It may sound like something that isn't likely, but we'll hear what Alistair has to say right after the break, so don't go away.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQX. Is a gold exploration company focused on their 23-kilometer, wholly-owned Dixie Project in the prolific Red Lake Mining District. Having recently made multiple high-grade gold discoveries, GBR is fully funded to complete their very active 90,000-meter drill program through next year. Considered one of the best-performing exploration stocks in the last 2 years, GBR aims to release a maiden resource in early 2020. To stay up to date, visit greatbearresources.ca.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Alistair McLeod. He's one of our more frequent guests here. Alistair writes a weekly column at goldmoney.com, and if you care at all about your economic future, you owe it to yourself, to your family, to your loved ones to read his column every week. And today I want to talk to Alistair about an article he wrote on October 3rd called An Inflationary Depression. And I'll start out just Alistair's his essays are always very good in the sense that the first you're introduced to it before you get into the meat of it. You have a big picture of what the story or what you're going to encounter. And he let in, just read the opening lines here from the October 3rd article that he wrote, An Inflationary Depression. He said, and I quote, "Financial markets are ignoring bearish developments in international trade, which coincide with the end of a long expansionary phase for credit. Both empirical evidence from the one occasion these conditions existed in the past and reason theory suggests that consequences of this collective folly will be enormous, undermining both financial asset values and fiat currencies. The last time this coincidence occurred was 1929 to 1932, leading into the Great Depression when prices for commodities and output prices for consumer goods fell heavily. With unsound money and a central banking determination to maintain prices, illusions of prosperity may continue to exist, but depression conditions will exist nonetheless." End of quote. So, Alistair, welcome, and I'm so happy that you could join us today because not a happy topic for sure, but I think an enlightening one. And I want to ask you, you wrote that on October 3rd. Of course, the action in the equity markets today and yesterday, too, suggests that some people may be having second thoughts about ongoing prosperity. But what are your thoughts about today's action, perhaps, and the equity markets?
Well, it's a 1% fall on a net basis. I think it was somewhat more than that during the trading session. But the interesting thing is that I think people are waking up to the problem that trade tariffs are likely to cause. That seems to be cited as the reason that the market has gone easier, and President Trump has made comments to that effect. So, yes, I think the edifice may be beginning to crack a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've been warning on this show at least a year ago or so that you felt the existing credit expansion was nearing its end. You felt even last year that we could very well be heading into a downturn as early as the fourth quarter of last year. Well, here we are. Now, of course, we know that recessions are always measured, you know, after the fact, and we're probably into a recession long before people acknowledge that we are in a recession. But do you think, are you seeing signs right now in the real world, not in the stock market necessarily, but are you seeing economic signs that the global economy is slowing down a bit?
Yeah, yes, very much so. The problem with trying to judge it is, of course, the whole thing is priced in funny money. So right. You have a situation where, you know, the world can be going to hell in a handcart and, you know, the GDP appears to grow. So it does make it rather difficult if you're just a statistician trying to look at things like, you know, PMI figures and inflation figures and all the rest of it. But the one thing that is absolutely clear is the volumes of cross-border trade, the sort of international trade, have actually contracted. That's almost come to a halt. Mm-hmm. And we see that the major economies who depend on America and or China are themselves running into difficulties. And there's no clearer example of this than Germany. Germany's economy is heading south quite rapidly, even in inflated euros. And we also have the worry that, of course, that the German banking system before this happened was getting into difficulties. I mean, quite visibly, we have seen the management at Deutsche Bank struggling with that behemoth, trying to stop it imploding. And you know, the situation, I think if you put a recession on top of that, this is an extra factor which actually could, you know, sort of destabilize the whole of the German banking system. And we're not even talking Italy, we're not even talking Greece, we're not even talking Spain. We're talking about the most important and strongest economy within the European Union. It is an extraordinary situation.
It is an extraordinary situation. I mean, you point out in your article that you had the confluence of those two events, the Smoot-Hawley in the 1930s and the expansion of the credit. Of course, the Chairman Powell and all the central bankers essentially seem to be very, very worried about another 2008, 2009. They seem to try to make sure that they're out ahead of it, so that they're proactive instead of reactive. Looks like they expect that they're never going to allow credit to contract again, at least if they can help it.
I think that's right. You make a very good point about them being worried. I think they are extremely worried. They know that the expansion of credit has not rescued the global economy since the Lehman crisis. I mean, it appears as if the American economy, the German economy, the EU, whatever, have just been sort of stuttering along with a little bit of growth, but never coming up to their potential. But you've got to bear in mind that the numbers that they're looking at in terms of real growth are after a heavily suppressed rate of inflation. I mean, the deflator, they say, is around about 1.5 to 2% in most of the major economies. There's no way it's that. It is considerably more. Now, you've just got to look at Shadowstats numbers or the Chapwood Index. Mm-hmm. Now, in America, it appears and they confirm each other that the current rate of price inflation is in the order of 9 or 10%. Now, if you use that deflator on your GDP, then America is already in a recession, and a very deep one, a slump, if you like. And it has been that way more or less ever since the initial shock after Lehman. So we have a situation where overburdened with unproductive debt, you can go on and on and on about all the things that are wrong. And then on top of all this credit expansion, as you point out, we have a Smoot-Hawley-like hit because America and China are ratcheting up tariffs against each other. And, what we're doing is we are turning the whole economy into the most enormous crisis by continuing with these policies. And bear in mind, it's not just one cycle that we're looking at from the Lehman crisis. We're looking at all the cycles which haven't washed out the bad debt, going all the way back, certainly into the late 90s, and probably quite a bit earlier. And you could even go back and make a case and say that this is a culmination of something that really started in August 1971, when Nixon suspended the Bretton Woods Agreement. In other words, the ability of just a few players in the big markets, like the central banks and the IMF and the World Bank, actually to redeem their dollars for gold. That was suspended at that stage. And ever since then, of course, monetary inflation has just been rip-roaring.
Yeah, for sure. And it's going into the financial sector, especially starting in the 1980s, I would argue, we started seeing this huge bond bull market, which is really transfer of wealth. And, of course, manufacturing and the sort of wealth-creating industries left America and went to China, and went to Mexico and other places. But you talk on page 2 of your latest, or of the October 3rd report, you talk about credit cycles within credit cycles and their increasing force. And that reminded me of an article that you wrote going back, 150 years of bank credit expansion is near its end. I mean, this sounds very almost cataclysmic, what you're talking about here. Could you explain that? I mean, 150 years going back to the Bank of England, I guess, way back, the 1800s.
Yes, indeed. I mean, we're going back to the Bank Charter Act of 1844, which is otherwise known as Peel's Banking Act. And basically what that did was that it set the terms whereby the Bank of England would back every note issued physically by gold. And in those mm-hmm. days, the sovereign mm-hmm. was £1. Mm-hmm. It's now over 300, by the way, just as a matter of interest. But it was a pound, and it was a pound, they called it sterling because originally we were on silver standard, but what it meant was that the Bank of England would not print another £5 note without having 5 sovereigns worth of gold added to its reserves. Now, that was absolutely fine. That's a sensible gold standard, gold exchange standard, however you like to call it, system. But what they missed was that banks, commercial banks, in their lending, could actually expand the quantity of credit, which was turned into money as soon as it hit people's deposit accounts. And so you had fiat currency in the middle of this, which couldn't be identified as different from money, which was actually properly backed by gold. The consequence of this was that you had a cycle of credit. And we had the Overend Gurney crisis, which I think was 1867. Overend Gurney was the biggest discount broker in London, discount house in London. And they were doing so well in this sort of credit expansion that they then sort of invested in things like railways. And of course, there was a railway crash and it wiped out Overend Gurney. And then you had the Baring crisis. That was, I think, for something like 1890. And when Baring, that was their first crisis, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, they had
went wrong 100 years later. But, you know, they invested in the Argentine, you know, which actually was a wonderful economy and all the rest of it. But it was a bubble. And next door in Brazil, there was a bubble as well. So guess what happened? I mean, the thing blew up in Baring's face. And if at that stage the other banks hadn't rallied around, helped by the Bank of England, coordinated by the Bank of England and Nathan Rothschild, if they hadn't rallied around Baring's, it could have wiped out the whole financial system. But this is a cycle of credit. And people just don't seem to understand that when they look at the boom and bust sequence, that the origin of it actually is the expansion of credit and then the catastrophe that always comes at the end of an expansion. The reason I'm going on about this is that this time we are seeing the culmination of several cycles, potentially, which really does mean that this one is going to be a big one. Now, a big one, I think, has a more than a likely chance that it will take out the fiat currencies. In other words, the fiat currencies, through this process, will themselves begin to collapse. Why? Because following the Lehman crisis, the central banks know that the only thing they can do is to just chuck new money into the system as much as possible to keep it going. The amount of money that's going to be required this time is considerably greater than was required at the time of the Lehman crisis. Now, this is why we're beginning to see central banks, bankers really worrying about it. Mm-hmm. We see the middle European countries accumulating gold, and not only that, but making sure they've got control over the gold. They're telling the Bank of England, come on, you know, we want our gold at home. So and these are people who have you know, most recently suffered from communism. They know the consequences of the socialization of money, and some of the brighter brains there are beginning to say, we've got to protect ourselves because there is a tsunami coming and we don't want to be wiped out for a second time in 40 years.
Mm-hmm. I'd like you to try to explain to our listeners, if you can, the most recent experience, of course, we had was 2008-2009 when we had this credit collapse. It almost got away from the central bankers. I think you'd agree with that. And then we had, at least for a brief period of time, collapsing prices everywhere because it had a snowballing effect. So most people believe that that's what we'll have again if we have any kind of problem at all. They can't really see rising prices. And we did, I think you would acknowledge, we did have a very brief period of deflation, or at least collapsing prices in the real world, not just in the financial markets, but in the real world for a brief period of time. And then they started stimulating and pumping money into the system again. Are you suggesting that this time they may not be able to get it to revive it again and have another cycle, catch the falling knife, as it were, they seem to have done in 2008-2009, that this time maybe the culmination of a major, going back as much as 150 years, a whole cycle of credit?
Well, the 150-year cycle, I'm really standing back and looking at the big, big, big picture.
Yeah, right.
But what you describe post-Lehman is a perfectly natural thing. I mean, you get just too much capacity in the economy. People are making too many of the same thing. And so when that went wrong, I mean, we remember Cash for Clunkers.
Sure.
You know, in this country, in Britain, we had a similar scheme. And I remember in the wake of that, there were some car manufacturers, I think Citroën in particular, who were almost offering on some models, buy one and get one free. You know, they just had to clear, because there were no buyers for it. You know, so they had to get rid of stock at any price. Uh-huh. Even Mercedes. I know of people who bought Mercedes at a 40% discount to the list price.
Wow.
And, you know, there were very few motor manufacturers who actually went through that without having very substantial cuts in price. So that happens when you get the crisis. When the crisis hits, suddenly you find that you know, people who would normally buy things on credit, whatever, they recoil. They stop doing that. And so you get that moment. But inevitably what happens is the central bank steps in and then really throws money at the problem to try and get prices up, because they believe that the only condition which is healthy is rising prices. So they're going to bring that about as quickly as they possibly can.
Well, that was the same idea as the 1930s, wasn't it? I think our Federal Reserve, our president, the executive and the Fed really tried to keep prices up as well, right? They didn't.
Yes.
They weren't very successful.
Well, there were two elements of that. I mean, President Hoover was trying to support prices, which basically meant that nothing could be sold. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, bear in mind that in the 1930s, the world, and particularly America, was on a gold standard. So prices were in effect in gold. And it was that led to the 40% devaluation of the dollar measured in gold from $20.67 to $35 in 1934. So, you know, the situation basically is one that leads to that sort of pressure on the currency. But I think it's going to be enormous this time, given the amount of fiat that's been printed since the Nixon shock in 1971.
So what is the solution for individuals? I mean, obviously, gold has been rising relative. Gold's purchasing power has been holding its own. The dollars has not. The dollar's purchasing power, as you pointed out earlier, hasn't held up nearly as well as they pretend it has. And the middle America, we have the opioid crisis. We have people that used to work in manufacturing in the middle America, the people that voted for Trump primarily, are hurting really badly. While the intelligentsia, the you know, people on both of the coasts that are involved in government or in the military-industrial complex or what have you are doing quite well, and they tend to be Trump haters, so more or less generalizing. But in terms of gold, we've had sort of depressed. I mean, gold continues to buy much more, and the dollar continues to buy much less. So I guess if you use gold as your currency, you know, we've had declining prices. If gold were our money, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think the way to look at it is that the dollar will lose purchasing power, as will the euro, as will sterling, as will the yen. They'll all lose purchasing power. And the faster that the central banks produce new money, QE, if you like, then potentially the more rapidly fiat currencies will lose their purchasing power. The only thing you can do is get out of fiat currencies, basically. Then what we're looking at is we're looking at gold. If you want to speculate a bit, possibly silver. Some of the younger guys listening to your radio show might want to go for Bitcoin. I wouldn't put them off doing that, but just get the hell out of fiat currencies. And the problem is we hang around waiting for it to happen and waiting and waiting and waiting, and we look at gold and we think of gold in terms of dollars, and we think, well, it's currently trading at 1470. It's rallied up from 1454 in the last four sessions. I think I'll wait until it comes back a bit. I mean, you can play those games if you like, but actually this is a lot more serious than a little bit of speculation and trying to save a dollar or two on the gold price.
So your bottom line, then, the advice that you give investors and just common folks is to get out of fiat if you can. Of course, pay off your debts if you can. And that's where a lot of people are going to be hurting really badly because there's so much debt.
Well, debt, sorry, if I can interfere, if I can cut across you. By the way, I don't give investment advice. I'm looking at monies.
I understand.
You know,
different
monies. When it comes to debt, it's an interesting one because private individuals across the world are now so much in debt that if the system collapses, then it's not just you, it's your neighbor, it's everybody else who is in exactly the same position. Now, that puts you in quite a powerful political position. So in a sense, if you've got a mortgage on your house, as long as you can continue to make the payments, you will probably see the thing through until the value of the repayment value of your mortgage is actually depreciated so much because of all the money that's been produced that you're probably going to be all right. So you've got to take, you know, sort of quite complex decisions of that sort. What you don't want to be is alone, because if you're alone and you're in trouble, nobody's going to come and rescue you. Right. If you're in there with millions in exactly the same situation, then basically the government will do everything they can to protect you. Not you as an individual, but collectively. So these are the sort of things you've got to think through, I think, quite carefully.
Alistair, I don't know if we'll have you on with just 30 seconds left. Next, we're coming to the end of the year. Will we see higher gold prices by this time next year than we see today? Today's gold price is moving up close to $1,500.
I will put it another way. You're going to see a lower dollar.
Okay. That's a good way of putting it, because we know that the gold is a constant measuring stick, isn't it? And it's the dollar that fools us.
People sound think money.
Everybody thinks in terms of the dollar, but it's really gold they should be thinking of. Alistair, thank you so much for being with us again. And if we don't talk to you until 2020, Happy New Year to you and happy holidays.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great being on. And I just want to wish all your listeners a not too bruising 2020. Let's hope it's a lot better than I think it will be.
Yeah, let's hope you're wrong. But it's better to be prepared than not to. So thank you so much, Alistair. We'll talk to you again soon. All right, folks. Well, that is all the time for today's show. Next week, my main guest will be Harry Dent. Well, he has a little different view, but he's a deflationist. I believe it's fair to say. We'll hear what he has to say and maybe compare them with what Alistair told us today. I expect I'll have a surprise guest or two as well. Until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
TriStar Gold is a gold exploration and development company listed on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol TSG and on the OTCQB under the symbol TSGZF. The large and growing gold resource at Castelo de Sanos project is located in mining-friendly Pará State, Brazil. A recent $8 million investment from major mining company Royal Gold will advance the CDS project towards a feasibility study in 2020. TriStar Gold enjoys strong institutional shareholder support from groups like Gold 2000, RBC, Sun Valley, and U.S. Global.